Okay, so right off the bat, let's have something proper. How does one know if an insight is stream entry? Very good. So for those of you who may be not familiar with the concept in Buddhism, I'm sure all of you have heard of the notion of enlightenment. So the idea of enlightenment in Buddhism is the idea that at certain deep stages in our spiritual practice, we can have a clear and fundamental vision of the truth of reality, which is so powerful that it will cut off forever and permanently certain of the defilements or the qualities, the delusions, the afflictions and so on in the mind, and that this process happens in terms of four stages. The first of those four stages is stream entry, and then the other stage is one's return, non-return, and arahantship is where one completely gets rid of all delusion and ignorance. So notice that these stages are permanent stages of realization. They're not permanent in the sense that they're fixed, but they're permanent in the sense that once those causes of suffering are gone, they're gone forever. Okay, so it's not like a permanent fixed state, but there's a what is free is the state of liberation is free. If you think like a prisoner who gets out of jail, like once you're out of jail, well, you're not stuck in freedom, are you? You're not sort of doing the same thing all the time. It's not a fixed state. But whatever you do, it has that quality of freedom to it. So it's the same thing with these four stages of enlightenment, that they have a quality of being permanent in the sense of being permanently freed from these defilements, as opposed to, say, the states of meditation and samadhi, which I've been talking about so far, mostly on the retreat, which are temporary states. Once they're over, then the mind goes back to normal, more or less. So the goal of doing all of this, of course, the goal of practicing the Eightfold Path and practicing meditation, ultimately the goal is to realize these various stages of enlightenment, starting with stream entry. And, of course, for most people, stream entry is the most immediate and apparently the most attainable of these goals. In the different Buddhist traditions, the goal of stream entry is somewhat variable in terms of how it's conceived as being, how attainable it is, how easy it is to become a stream enterer. There are many stories in the Buddhist scriptures which seem to suggest that in the Buddha's day, many people would become stream enterers just by listening to a good Dhamma talk. However, as a historical scholar, I have to issue the warning that almost all of those stories are not particularly historically plausible for one reason or another. These days, it's quite common that stream entry is said to be something which is fairly readily attainable by lay practitioners through doing intensive retreats such as the one that we're doing at the moment. And in fact, historically, the very institution and the popularity of the meditation retreat was originally because they were designed in order to bring people to a state of stream entry following a retreat or during a retreat. As to how you know whether you're a stream enterer or not, the basic it's always very difficult to assess these things, right? So first of all, we just sort of acknowledge that the experience that we have in meditation, when you have a profound experience of any kind in meditation, the experience itself is clear, yeah? But what that experience means is not necessarily so obvious. Yeah? So we can have many kinds of experiences in meditation. And at the time, mind is very clear, and it's obviously a very powerful experience of some sort or another, but we're not necessarily sure of what all the implications of that are. There are a few things we can say about the experience of stream entry. One is that it's a definite experience that happens at a certain time and place. In the monastic Vinaya, the code of discipline for monks and nuns, this is one of the ways that they're instructed to test, to see whether somebody's making a false claim. So if you've got a monk or a nun who's pretending that they're enlightened, but they're not really enlightened, one of the ways that you test whether they are is by inquiring about the experience. When did it happen? Where did it happen? And if they can't give you these details clearly and decisively, then that shows that it wasn't the real experience. Okay, so whenever it happens, you know it. In one of the suttas, it describes the experience of stream entry as being like a flash of lightning in the dark night. So rather than the experience of samadhi, which is a gradual deepening and clarifying of the mind into states of a consciousness which last for successively longer periods of time, the experience of insight is something which just happens. And as many of the stories in the Theragatha and Therigatha remind us again and again, that these things can't be predicted. They happen in all kinds of mysterious and unexpected ways. In fact, the majority of these experiences, it seems to me, happen in the least expected moment, like the story of Bhadra I told the other night, where she was washing her feet and the water drained away and then it just came to her. So when that experience happens, it will be a very powerful experience. You will know that something very important has happened. You won't necessarily know what that is, and this is where the role of what they call pachyavekana comes in. Pachyavekana literally means reviewing. And pachyavekana is a process which happens after that experience. And it's a process of testing and reflecting and reviewing about what that experience was. Because it's extremely common, in fact it's virtually universal, that meditators, while they're practicing and during the course of developing meditation, will have some kind of experience that they will take to be something that it's not. People will think this is a jhana, this is a psychic power, this is a vision of devas, this is an enlightenment experience or whatever. And in fact it's nothing of the sort. So these things happen to most meditators during the course of their development. Okay, it's not unusual, and in itself it's not problematic. The only thing which is problematic is when you get stuck on it and you get attached to it, and then it becomes problematic. I had a friend when I was in Thailand. He's a Sri Lankan monk, and he told me his story. When he'd first ordained, he had practiced extremely diligently. He would meditate after the noontime meal. He would meditate until from midday. He would do walking meditation until from midday till 6 o'clock in the evening, and then he'd sit meditation from 6 in the evening to midnight, and then he would sleep for about 3 or 4 hours, and then he'd get up and meditate again from about 4 in the morning till about 10 in the morning. And then he would prepare for his meal and so on and do all of his business in that time and then keep on going. And he did that for a year or so. And he thought he became an arahant, right? And he went and he started a meditation center and was teaching, and all of his students also thought he was an arahant. And after some time, he had the wish to develop psychic powers. And so maybe he wanted to learn to read people's minds, because not all arahants, not all enlightened people will have the ability to read minds or these kinds of things. So he wanted to have that so he could help him with teaching. Yeah? He could read people's minds and then tell them how to meditate. So he went off to find another teacher who could teach him how to read minds. And the way he told this interview was very funny. He said he went to see this teacher. He said, "I want you to teach me psychic powers." And the monk said, do you have any former meditation experience?" He said, "Yes, I am an arahant." And so this other teacher, very fortunately, was quite skilled and experienced. And rather than saying to him, "You know, no, you're not an arahant," he gave him a series of meditation practices to do. And through doing those practices, he realized that actually he wasn't an arahant, nor a non-returner, nor a once-returner, and not even a little stream enterer, but just an ordinary Joe Blow. And what was quite nice about that was that, you know, he then accepted that. He had the humility. But you can see that in that kind of situation, it's actually very hard. Most people in that kind of situation would immediately dismiss the other teacher. They don't know what they're doing, and they go on. So this is where it becomes problematic, is where that conceit and sense of self comes around those spiritual attainments. Remembering that the attainment itself might be quite good. Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt he had good meditation. His mind was very clear. You know, it wasn't as if he was, you know, just, you know, completely deluded or anything. Actually, he had progressed a long way in his practice. It was very serious and very diligent, and he had purified his mind to a great degree. But it's just that he misunderstood what that was. So when you have these kind of experiences, then if you have the opportunity to go talk to somebody who has the experience and who can give advice on it, then that's good. The most important thing is to always keep on reflecting, and keep on reflecting in yourself. Keep on reflecting. Keep on reflecting. And I remember when a story I heard when Ajahn Brahm went to Sri Lanka. He visited a very old German monk called Nyanawimala, and Nyanawimala's advice was that. I may be confusing this story. Anyway, it was Nyanawimala's advice. I can't remember if it was to Ajahn Brahm or not. But anyway, a piece of advice that he gave was that never announce your attainments even to yourself. Yeah. So if you think you've got any of these kinds of things, if you want to talk about it, you go to a teacher and you say, "Well, this is what my experience was like. What do you think this signifies, or how should I practice further?" But you don't go and say, I'm at this, I'm that, or I've got this, or I've got that. Okay, if it's a good teacher, they don't want to listen to somebody telling them what they've got, but what they want to hear about is what someone's experience is like, yeah? So that it gives them some meaning, so that then if there's any guidance necessary, you can offer the guidance. If not, then there's no need. So this, I mean, this, the specific things that the stream enterer has got rid of is three things: is doubt, okay, because they've seen the Four Noble Truths, they've seen the path of practice, so they know what those things are, so they can't ever have any doubts about the way of practice. Of course, that doesn't mean you can't have doubt about, you know, is the 3:20 bus arriving on time or not. That's not what it means. But it means you don't have any doubt about what is the practice, okay? What are the essential truths of the path and so on. You can obviously even have doubts about minor details of the Dhamma or Vinaya, yeah? But not about the essential principles. Also, you have got rid of what they call sila bhatta paramasa, which means the misapprehension of virtue and vows. They're usually translated as attachment to rites and rituals, but better translation is the misapprehension of virtue and vows. So what that means is essentially that you no longer believe that by doing external practices or through behavior alone that you can reach purification. Okay. That's not to say that a stream enterer is also one who's perfected in their sila. So that doesn't mean that they discount the value of sila and the value of ethics. It just means that they understand that through those external practices alone, this can't get them enlightened. And the other thing which they've got rid of is sakaya ditti, is the attachment to a sense of self, or identifying oneself with one of the five aggregates. So what essentially that means is that the stream enterer can't have a view or an idea that their ultimate permanent self is something or other. Okay? But the stream enterer still has almost a subtle kind of precognitive or pre-reflective sense of identity, which remains to be extinguished by the higher paths. But they couldn't have a sort of a view of the self or an ideology of it, a theory of it. So if you have a kind of one of these experiences, then this is a matter for the reflection and investigation. You learn about what are the qualities of a stream enterer. The stream enterer has perfected sila, they've perfected faith in the triple gem, they have perfected their dana. They have an understanding of dependent origination. They have possessed the five spiritual faculties and so on. So you learn about what those qualities of a stream enterer are, and then you investigate and see, well, are those qualities present in me? And that's a kind of an ongoing investigation and reflection. And over time, then you can come to see whether that's that attainment or whether it's something else. Okay, Bhante, please give us the reference for Bhikkhu Bodhi's account of Sampajanya. Okay, I mentioned a couple of nights ago, Bhikkhu Bodhi gave an excellent translation of the commentary's description of Sampajanya, or clear comprehension, and that's found in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of the text and commentary of the Samanyapala Sutta, Digha Nikaya 2, which he translates it as, I think, the fruits of the contemplative life, I believe. The fruits of recluseship. He translated the title of the fruits of recluseship. It's published by the BPS in Sri Lanka, and the most common edition is a kind of a brown cover. They'll have it in the Buddhist Society library. So that's the fruits of recluseship. It's also, most of that account is similar, found also in the Visuddhimagga, which is translated as the path of purification, which is very widely available. Okay. Oh, Bhante, can you please briefly go through the other Brahma Viharas? Okay. So, metta, unconditional love. Very simple, very childlike, very naive. Compassion, understands suffering. Okay? Compassion understands suffering. Metta is like white wine, compassion is like red wine. Compassion is richer and deeper and more mature, yeah? But compassion, compassion is a more profound emotion because it includes that understanding of suffering. But one also has to be a little bit careful in developing the meditation on compassion, where metta meditation for almost everyone is not counterindicated, right? There's almost nothing that can go wrong with metta meditation except that, you know, it doesn't work and you get a bit frustrated, but that's about all. Whereas with compassion, because it involves an identification with the suffering of others, then if you're not mindful and you're not well established in yourself enough, you can over-identify with suffering. And so then that can cause yourself, in fact, to suffer and even to get into depression and these kinds of things if you're not ready for it. So that's why I'm a little bit more, I think it's good to develop the metta first. Not that that's going to happen to everyone, but just for some people that might be the case. If you don't have a strong sense of self already established, then you can over-identify. Mudita, they translate is means I'm just trying. That's what it means. Because there's no proper word in English, okay? And it's very frustrating because English should have a good word for mudito, but it doesn't. And so they translate it as sympathetic joy, which is not really a word and doesn't really mean that anyway, and altruistic joy. But the problem is mudita in Pali is language. In altruistic joy isn't really language, is it? It's kind of what they call Buddhist hybrid English. You know, it's not something you actually find in the world. So mudita, rejoicing perhaps? Maybe rejoicing is better. Anyway, mudita essentially means the rejoicing or the celebrating of the goodness of others. So mudita, for example, is what we do every morning when we have the dana offering and the food is offered and then we give the blessing. We call anumodana. It's actually from the same root as the word mudita. And anumodana is the rejoicing along with the offering. Often we say in English, we say this is a blessing, but actually it's not really a blessing in that sense, but it's the rejoicing along with the recognition of this kind act which has been done and the bringing of the joy to one's own mind and encouraging others to rejoice also in their goodness. So this is mudita. So if I'm going to continue my little metaphor along, if metta is like white wine and compassion is like red wine, then mudita is like champagne. Okay, so that's what you crack out when there's the celebrations. And upekkha is the last one, is translated as equanimity, but upekkha literally means watching over. Okay, it literally means watching over or watching closely over something. So equanimity doesn't mean indifference. That's a very important distinction here. And the way to understand this distinction is if you think about the difference between being disinterested and uninterested. Right? Can you see the difference between those two? If you've been taken to court, you want your judge to be disinterested but not uninterested, right? So if the judge is uninterested, they're sitting there falling asleep, they're bored, they're not paying attention, and they don't really care what happens. That's an uninterested. Disinterested means that they're not biased one way or another. They're not taking anyone's side, but they'll listen impartially and only be guided by the truth. Yeah, that's what disinterested means. So equanimity is disinterested, but it's not uninterested. Okay. In fact, equanimity is very interested. So equanimity is watching closely over, yeah, taking great care. And also notice equanimity emerges from these others. If we try to practice too much equanimity without metta and compassion and mudita, then almost certainly we actually tend up with that we tend to go to that side of being uninterested, of not caring. Yeah, And you see a lot of that in Buddhism. Yeah, what people pretend to be is equanimity and so on. And actually, it's just the lack of compassion, lack of caring. So equanimity, always remember, emerges from those other things. And again, to follow the simile through, then equanimity would be like a clear glass of spring water. Yeah. This is the non-alcoholic Brahma-vihara, okay? Well, all the others are alcoholic because they're kind of intoxicating. You get intoxicated with the bliss of metta and so on. And whereas equanimity, it's very clear. Yeah, you see everything properly. Okay, so in this retreat, I focused really on just doing metta and one of the main reasons I do that is to keep things simple. Okay, I don't want people to be confused and trying too many different things. Many of you have experienced the fact that just doing the metta is already quite a challenge, and to stick with that and to take it into depth and really explore it is, I think, a very, very important thing. Once you understand how to do that, then it won't be difficult to explore the other Brahma-viharas. So if you want to take, once you understand the metta practice, you want to then experiment with doing the compassion, the mudita, the equanimity, following similar lines and principles, then that won't be too difficult. Okay, next question. These are so random. I love these questions. Okay. Were the Jatakas recited at the first council? So random historical question here. Okay, so to understand this, for those of you who are not versed in Buddhist history, when the Buddha taught entirely orally. He never wrote anything down. And, of course, all spiritual literature at that time in India was oral. So his disciples would remember, recite, and pass those scriptures down. Initially, that was done on a fairly ad hoc basis, right? So that, you know, you can imagine what the situation would be like, that, you know, maybe you might be, say, living in a monastery in a certain village. The Buddha's wandering around from place to place. He comes to your village and he gives some teachings. And you can imagine that you'd be so excited. All the monks would come. Everyone would come to listen. And you'd sit there and listen so carefully and intently. Because it's not like today where you can, you know, go on the internet and get whatever teachings you want, download some MP3s or whatever. This is your only chance, yeah, to listen to the teachings. So you're really paying attention well. And the Buddha would teach in a way that's very clear. He would teach in a way that's adapted to the level of the listener and in a way that people can understand and was relevant and important to them. And he would also teach in a way that was, the literary style was carefully crafted in a way that so that people could remember, because they knew, everyone knew that, well, you're going to have to remember these teachings. When the teaching was taught, the monks would go away, or the nuns or the lay people or whoever would go away. They would repeat those teachings, go over them in their mind again and again, and recite them and so on. And so you might have different communities in different places that would have records of what the Buddha taught, which is, you know, might be quite different. The Buddha taught different things in different times and places. And so there's a kind of an ongoing movement, because then, of course, the monks, the nuns, the lay people are also moving from one place to another, so they would also be then repeating these teachings at different times. And there would be attempts to gather these teachings together, collate them and organize them and so on. And this is all happening during the Buddha's lifetime. After the Buddha died, shortly after, according to the traditional account, which is found in the vineyards of all the schools of Buddhism, the Sangha got together under the leadership of Mahakassapa in Rajagaha and recited all of the scriptures. Now, every one of the vineyards has an account of that. We have 6 or 7 accounts of the First Council. All of them agree on the general outlines of it, but all of them disagree on the specific details. And in particular, all of them say that what was recited at the First Council was their own canonical collection. Okay? So the Pali version of it says that it was the Pali scriptures that were recited. The Sarvastivadin version said it was the Sarvastivadin version recited. The Mahasanghika version says it was the Mahasanghika scriptures recited. And I think you can see a pattern emerging here. So what really happened, of course, then becomes a matter of conjecture. Most likely, the First Council or something like it did happen, although it's also important to remember that that's part of a process. It's not just one isolated single event. It's a significant event in part of an ongoing process. Since all of the versions more or less agree on what the general content of what was recited, so I think that's there's no reason to think that that they're kind of wrong in those very general outlines, although the specifics, as I said, do vary. Most likely, to come back to then the question of the Jatakas, I think what was recited at the First Councils was the important, the central scriptures, especially those mostly found in the Sanyutta Nikaya and other important suttas in the four Nikayas, as well as the Patimokkha, the code of discipline, the code of rules for bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and certain of the other procedures in the Vinaya. I'm fairly confident that much was recited around that time. There may well have been other things as well. The Jataka collections as we have them today, the 550 stories in Pali and the various other collections in the northern traditions, would not have been recited, and they came into the Buddhist tradition at a somewhat later date, there may have been a few of those stories and a few Jataka stories which are among the ones which today are found in the four Nikayas. A few of those may have been recited at that time, but certainly the full collection of 550 Jatakas wouldn't have been. Okay, so the Buddha said, I do not argue with the world. The world argues with me. No one who proclaims the true Dhamma disputes with anyone in the world. So that's a statement. I'm not quite sure if that calls for a response. But I would argue that that's just wrong. No, hang on. Well, it's an interesting statement because it's one of those things which is very profound. But the reality is, if you look in the suttas, the Buddha's going around arguing with people all the time. I mean, the whole Digha Nikaya is the Buddha basically arguing with people. So he does it very nicely, but these kind of statements have to be interpreted in the broader picture of things. The Buddha certainly felt there was nothing wrong with engaging with people about what they believed and expressing his disagreement with them in giving reasons why he disagreed, in trying to persuade people that that they were mistaken, and so on and so forth. And we find these things constantly in the Buddhist scriptures. So what I think this is saying here is that the Buddha is not doing that out of any kind of sense of hostility or ill will, and he's not kind of on a mission to try to convert everybody or anything like that. But he's, I think, there's a difference between arguing with and engaging with, and I think this is what we see through the Buddhist scriptures. The Buddha is engaging in quite a meaningful way with people all the time. Okay, so what's the connection between metta and unconditional love, and is it similar to universal love? Yes, basically all just words for the same thing, really. And just, I do like that notion of unconditional love, because I think I mentioned that a bit earlier, that normally a sense of love is very conditional. It's like, well, I'll give love to you if you give something back to me, and I'll love you because you make me feel good, because you fulfill some kind of need that I have. So the unconditional love is the love that doesn't make those kinds of bargains. Why are Dhamma books left on the floor? Isn't it more respectful to put it on the cushion or the chair? Oops. Absolutely, those evil, nasty people with their books on the floor. in Buddhist culture, and I think in Asian cultures generally, that there's felt the floor is felt to be a place which is not clean, and sacred objects or things which are respectful, such as Dhamma books, wouldn't be left on the floor but be kept in a higher place. So as a general rule, then that's definitely the case. It is a bit awkward with chanting books, and certainly in most of the monasteries that I've been in, practically speaking, it's a bit fuzzy as far as chanting books goes, because actually we are sitting on the floor. It's kind of difficult to have the books next to you when you're actually occupying the cushion. And I'm not sure that it's actually any more respectful to put the book somewhere where your bum goes. That's probably one for the experts to sort out. So I personally don't have a problem in this kind of environment where we do have a very clean floor. The books aren't going to be kicked around or mishandled or misused, and it's quite pragmatic for the chanting books. But certainly as far as the ordinary Dhamma books and so on, to keep them somewhere respectful is good. Okay. Why did you become a monk? Did your girlfriend dump you? Oh, that's why I like being in Australia. Yeah. did my girlfriend dump me? Well, perhaps you should ask her that. No. It's just when I get asked this question very often, and the kind of the full story of how I became a monk is something that I've never actually revealed. Okay. It remains a secret, and one of these days I'll probably reveal that secret, but it probably won't be until, you know, quite a while. Anyway, the short answer to that is that when I was living in Australia, living as a musician, I sort of, over a period, sort of gradually began to have more of a feeling of I guess, just kind of being lost, of being alienated, and that kind of spurred my decision to go and spend a year in Thailand, basically just to do something different. I wanted to take myself out of the world that I knew and go somewhere different and see what life would present to me. So I was on a kind of a search, but it wasn't a kind of explicitly a spiritual search. I wasn't looking for religion or anything. But when I arrived in Thailand, it was in Chiang Mai, and it was a kind of curious sequence of events. I was staying in a guest house in Chiang Mai called the Eagle House, which is a great guest house if you ever want to stay in a guest house in Chiang Mai. There's a little plug here for my friends Pon and Annette. Go to Eagle House, they'll look after you. Tell them Sujata sent you. And I was staying there for a while, and I was trying to get a job in Chiang Mai. I didn't have much money. I had $1,000 US, so I was going to live in Thailand for a year. So I wanted to get a job, earn a bit of money and so on, and nothing was working. No one would give me, you know, let me play guitar anywhere or anything like that. So I heard about this retreat that was on offer in a monastery called Wat Rampang, which is one of the still very few places in Thailand that offers meditation retreats in English. So I went there, and they have 26 day retreats usually. The retreats there are individual retreats, so you can come any time and they'll just start you on the retreats. So different people are cycling through the retreats. They're not like one fixed time, but you just start whenever you get there. And it's extremely intensive. It was very hot and uncomfortable, and there was a revolution while we were on retreat. It was in 1992. It was one of the kind of semi-annual revolutions in Thailand. Well, I had a revolution as well, yeah. I had many profound experiences in the meditation, and I knew after that I just wanted to keep practicing Dhamma. So after that, I did what I could. And the extraordinary thing was that after I came out, all of those things that I'd been looking for before just kind of fell in my lap. I went back to the Eagle House, and Pon and Annette, this is not an exaggeration, as soon as I came back, the owners of the guest house said, "We want to adopt you as our son in Thailand. You can stay here as long as you like. You don't have to pay anything. You don't have to pay any food." And by the way, Pon, the husband, had gone to high school with Thailand's biggest rock band. We'll find you gigs playing music in Chiang Mai, and we'll be, you know, talking about recording contracts and blah, 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 blah. So, and that just happened when I came out of the retreat. And so that's what I did. Stayed in Chiang Mai for a while. Worked, played music in various venues, sometimes three times a night, and got a job teaching English and did various kinds of things, and did a number of other things during that period as well. But eventually I ended up at Wat Nanachat, and Wat Nanachat in northeast Thailand was the branch monastery for English-speaking monks. It's a place where Ajahn Brahm also was in the early days. And I just really loved it. I really loved the lifestyle, and I really found that this is what the Buddha was talking about. You know, I'd been reading the suttas and reading these teachings, and then realized, well, this is actually, you know, if this is what I want to practice, I was very clear in my mind. I really wanted to keep practicing this Dhamma as best as I could. And this is obviously the ideal way to do it. After being at Wat Nanachat for a few couple of months, we went on retreat into the jungle I was talking about the other night. And so it was there that I came to the decision to become a monk. Okay, so that's basically how that happened. So, but you still don't have the real story. One of these days. Okay, Pante, I have a problem. My mind is thrilled by your talks. I can't get enough. I know. So one request. On Saturday, our last full day, can we change the format around and have 8 hours of talks and 2 hours of meditation? I remember the first 9-day retreat I taught in Malaysia, and after the talks, one of the guys came up and said, "Oh, your talk last night was your talk's been so good. I've much prefer, you know, thinking about your talks rather than meditating." So I'm thinking, I'll try to make them more boring in the future. I think that keeping the current balance of talks and meditation is good. You know, it's one of the things as someone who, you know, do teaching regularly and so on, and I'm very conscious that to not do it too much, you know. Like, I don't teach too many retreats and I try not to do too much because there's a kind of a limit, and after a while it just becomes mechanical and it just becomes rote. And I know that there are some people who teach retreats constantly, one after the other, and I can't imagine how you do that, you know. And it's very difficult. So I think it's important for me to just have that space, and that's what keeps like a freshness about it. And that's also why I always like to challenge myself by doing different things. I think if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, you get stale very easily. Okay, dear Bhante, is bowing purely for cultural and ritual purposes only, or does it have another meaning that would help our practice not only in meditation but also as a Buddhist? I find bowing is very humbling. It reduces my ego. So, well, bowing is one of these things which, you know, like any external practice, it depends on the meaning that we bring to it. It's not the practice itself, but it's the meaning that we infuse it with. I mentioned a little while ago when I was talking about the stream enterer, one of the things that the stream enterer lets go of is this misapprehension of silabata, of virtues and vows, or this idea that through external behaviour that you can reach enlightenment. But there's an interesting sutta in the Solasapanha of the Suttanipata, where the Buddha says that you can't become enlightened by means of sila and vata, by means of precepts and practices, but nor can you get enlightened without them. And I think this is also important to recognise. So the practice of bowing that we do in order to show respects to the Triple Gem or to the teacher or something like that. And it's important. It is a very culturally determined practice in many Asian cultures. Still today, the children will bow to their parents before they go to school in the morning. Yeah, and you know, it's a sign of respect. There's a very beautiful song in Thailand. It was the only Thai song that I learnt to sing, called Dern Pen, and it means full moon. And it's a song which is incredibly popular in Thailand. You go, all the bands will play it. Everyone will do their version of it. It's a bit like the Thai version of, you know, Blowing in the Wind or something like that. And it's a story which about this young man who was drafted as a soldier and sent off to war. And it's just the story of his feelings of when he's going off to war and he sees the full moon shining down, and he thinks that this same full moon that's shining down here is shining down over his home where his family is there, and he thinks with such longing and such love for his parents, all he wants to do is to go home and bow down at his mother's feet, and that's all he wants to do. And so this is the song which is kind of sung in all of the nightclubs and the pubs and so on in Thailand, you know. And I'm thinking, I'm comparing it with what I was brought up on, you know. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticise what you don't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command, and so on. So there's a kind of very different attitude. But part of that story was that he was told genuinely by a soldier who went off to war, and he was killed in the war. He never did go back to his family. So bowing is part of that kind of, within that kind of context, is like entering into a very kind of respectful and very loving relationship with someone. It's not an expression of kind of subservience or abasement, but an expression of respect and love. Okay, I have read that the Buddha was a great yogi and Ayurvedic practitioner. Is that true? It kind of depends what you mean by those things. There's no actual historical, real historical evidence for either the practice of yoga or the practice of Ayurveda as we know them today, until maybe 1,000 or 1,500 years after the Buddha. When we use the word yoga in modern times, we often mean, you know, physical exercises they call asana, although, of course, this is only one of the 8 steps in Patanjali's Ashtanga yoga. So generally speaking, in Indian spiritual literature, the idea of a yogi doesn't mean somebody who's doing, you know, yoga exercises, but it just means a dedicated spiritual practitioner or a meditator. So in that sense, the Buddha obviously was a great yogi. And was he an Ayurvedic practitioner? No particular mention of him doing that. It's likely that before he was ordained, as, you know, someone in the aristocracy, he would have been brought up and educated in, you know, the different kind of arts and sciences that were available at the time. So it's not at all implausible that he would have at least a basic knowledge of the medical principles at the time. But nowhere that really says that he was an Ayurvedic specialist. In fact, of course, we know that the Buddha was attended by the Dr. Jivaka, who was indeed a great Ayurvedic specialist or medical practitioner. So that kind of suggests that the Buddha himself wasn't. But this is completely beside the point of that question, but there's a wonderful story with regards to Jivaka, the Buddha's doctor. And this is a story found in the Vinaya, and it's a story about his training as a doctor. So in those days they went to Taxila and spent many years studying with a teacher to learn all about medicine and all the different kinds of medicine, and they were doing surgery and all of these kinds of things. And there's accounts in the Vinaya of Jivaka removing brain tumours and various other kinds of things. So at the end of his training, his teacher says to Jivaka, okay, here's your test. And I really love this because I'm someone, when I went through school and university, I always hated tests, because I always thought tests are ridiculous, because you can always fake a test and actually get a good mark in a test without actually knowing much about what the subject was. I know that from experience, that's what I used to do. But and so he said, here's the test. Okay, the test is you take a horse and a cart, you drive out of the city gates at dawn, you spend all day driving around outside, and you bring back everything that is not medicine. And Jivaka's like, that's impossible. Yeah, there's no way I could bring everything that's not medicine back in just one cart. He says, well, you've got to try. He says, all right. So he goes out in the morning, comes back in the evening with an empty cart. And his teacher says, ah, congratulations, you've passed. Yeah. So it's a very beautiful thing. Everything is medicine, yeah? Everything has a use, everything has a purpose. Okay. Okay, so here's just a little note to remind ourselves. What we're doing is not just meditating, we're purifying ourselves in the Buddhist way. We are accumulating merit, and please give generously our loving kindness and share it to people who support us and bring us such great meals every day. Thank you. So there you go, a bit of positive affirmation there. Did I read this one before? What decided to make me made me decide to become a monk? I thought I already did that one. Maybe it's a repeat. Okay, so I think that's it for now. So it's nearly 9 o'clock. So I think I've gone through the questions, although yesterday I did mix them up, as you saw. So if I haven't read your question, then that's probably just because it got mixed with the ones that I thought I'd read already. So if you're still waiting for your question to be read, then please just write it down again, and I'll get around to it later on. So happy meditating. I'll go off and get ready for the interviews. And just to let you know, I've cancelled the interview session for this afternoon. Unfortunately, I have a meeting. Yes, which I can't get out of, so have a teleconference. My apologies. So, but we'll have the interviews in this morning as usual.